Hi, my name is Sam Blizzard. Welcome to Comms from the Shed, the interview show where you get to hear from a range of diverse and interesting voices on how they've coped during the global pandemic. In this series, we'll be taking an informal look at life, talking to people who've been doing incredible things, and asking them about their hopes for the future in both their personal and professional lives. Hope you enjoy it. Today we welcome journalist and author Leo Moynihan, who's been a sports writer for 21 years. He's written for 442 magazine, The Sunday Telegraph, The Times, ES magazine and Esquire, amongst others. His books include Three Kings, The Makers of Modern Football, which was shortlisted for the British Sports Book Awards Football Book of the Year. His latest book, Thou Shall Not Pass, The Anatomy of Football's Centre-Half, has just been published by Bloomsbury and is out now. Leo Moynihan, welcome to Comms from the Shed.
Hi, Sam. Thank you for having me in your shed.
At one point, I did entertain the notion of having a big flat screen in here for a major summer football tournament, but we'll see how that pans out.
Oh, you've got to do it.
I know that you're probably writing all the time, but what were the challenges of publishing a book in lockdown? And in some ways, was that actually an advantage?
You know, most writers' lives are sitting in their sheds like you are, or their living rooms. I've been doing that for 20 years. So a lot of people were ringing me for advice when all this started. But I've got to say, it sort of changed my work and my motivation, knowing that everyone else was at home. It definitely changed how I went about my business. And what I love doing is going to meet people and trying to, whenever you can, sit with people and talk face to face. You always get a much better interview than anything on the phone. And suddenly this thing called Zoom was proposed, which I guess had been around for a while, but I'd never heard of it. And I started doing interviews on Zoom, which was very odd, sitting, especially as you're interviewing quite famous footballers, and they're standing in their beautiful kitchens making vegan dinners while you talk to them. So it kind of sent everything a bit topsy-turvy, but we'll get on with it. And as I say, writers really shouldn't complain, but we do.
Thanks for your thoughts there on lockdown publishing, Leo. My next question is related to the book, actually. Why are centre-halves so misunderstood in the world of football? And what have you learned about people that play in that position?
I think depending where you are in the world of football, centre-halves are either lauded or, as you say, misunderstood and slightly caricatured. I think the centre-half is seen as this sort of caricature, the big guy, broken nose, plays the game, facing the game, very square on to the action, and his job or her job is very much the bruiser. I spoke to foreign centre-halves who played their game successfully abroad, Germany, France, Holland, South America, Spain, and then they'd come to England. The first thing they'd do was maybe make a tackle and the ball would go out for a throw-on, and to their bemusement, there'd be a loud cheer from the crowd. Our football culture, it's coming out of it, I think, but we do live in a time, we have lived in a time where the big tackle, the big header away is celebrated, whilst the players that do it are slightly frowned upon. There's a bit of a snobbery around them. It was fascinating for me, having played in the position at amateur level myself, to get more into it, and actually found the second part of your question, I found that there is sort of caricature, character assessments of all these guys that are similar. You know, the British centre-half I spoke to, they do all agree that they are quite organised. They are quite in their home life even. They like to structure things. So I think we're looking at sports people that want, in their very own life, they want to sort of carry a high line and maybe, you know, play life's problems offside. That makes sense.
No, it absolutely does. Thank you for that. That's given us a bit of a rare insight into one of the less glamorous positions on the football field. Can I just ask you, where did your twin loves of football and journalism come from?
I was sort of born into it. My father was the football correspondent on the Sunday Telegraph for about 25 years from the late 60s to when Fleet Street sort of finished. He kind of finished when they moved to London's Docklands. So I was very much immersed in that world. My dad would go to a match every Saturday. There were less games midweek back then. on the Sunday I'd see him, and I'd get the programme from the match with all his little penned writings in the pages. It was the good old days. So as I got a little bit older, Dad would actually sit me on his lap in press boxes while he had a typewriter and watch the game. And I sort of grew up around his ilk, and you know, some of his best friends, great writers like Frank Keating, was very close to me. And to listen to them talk, and it was this sort of romantic time of Fleet Street wine bars and cigar smoke, the clacking of typewriters. So my love for football certainly came from that, and being taken to press boxes from the age of sort of six, I think it was. And then at school, I wasn't the most academic of kids, but I did like writing. And I guess that was always going to be the case. And, you know, I was writing match reports rather than doing homework a lot of the time. So I think, as I say, it was sort of, I was going to have to give it a go. It was one of those. And I wanted to play football like all boys did, and got quite far, but then it didn't happen for me. So I went to university and did an English degree that I've never really thought about since or used. But it definitely, in terms of book writing, I think my degree got me used to sitting down and writing longer pieces, the discipline of doing that. And so, yeah, I'm an apple that didn't fall far from the tree.
In learning more about you, preparing for this interview, you've written lots of articles and lots of books, and I can't not ask you about something that's mentioned in your biography, which is your ghosting project with David Beckham.
Yeah, so that was, that was around 2006, because I won't say David, because we're not sort of first name time perms, but Mr. Beckham was, he was playing for Real Madrid at the time. So I was approached, I'd written a book on Gordon Strachan. I didn't ghost it, but I wrote a biography on Gordon Strachan, who was quite a cult figure at the time, fellow countryman of yours, Sam. And then that went down quite well. And so HarperCollins got in touch with me saying that they were looking to do a new book with Beckham for sort of a younger audience. David Beckham was opening a new football academy in Greenwich. I don't know if you remember him doing that, this huge sort of two football pitches, but it was going to be open to schools, and there was going to be teaching facilities in it, as well as obviously the physical side of things. So he wanted to do HarperCollins and him wanted to do a kind of coaching manual, but also a biographical thing about how he made his dreams come true sort of thing. It was all very uplifting stuff. And so they asked me to do a treatment for it, a pitch for the book, which I did. And I got the job. So it was quite, I mean, this was at the time, I mean, he was still playing. He was probably the most famous British guy around, I think, at the time. So I went to meet him for the first time. He was 6 hours late, but his private jet had problems. So we all know how that feels. So that was fine. And we kind of got chatting. Actually, at first, I made a little joke about his age, because I'm actually a year older than him, and I went to the same soccer school, Bobby Charlton's soccer school, as him when we were teenagers. And I remember hearing about this great kid who was Manchester United were going to sign. So I thought that was a great icebreaker. And he asked me my age, and I made the mistake of saying, you wouldn't know it to look at me, but I'm older than you. And it didn't go down too well, actually. And I thought I'd lost the gig. But we persevered, and we brought it round. And that was my first steps into ghosting. I'd obviously written articles for magazines in the first person, which is sort of similar. But I had to convince HarperCollins and David Beckham's people, there were quite a lot of his people, that I would need quite a lot of time with him to do a book, which was like breaking down barriers. But we got there, and I was flown to Madrid, and I'd spend I'd have day trips to Madrid to do a sort of 2-hour interview with him. And he was very pleasant. And as I say, it was talking about his childhood and his way in, really, and his passion for football, which really came across. I think at the time I said it was like dealing with the President of the United States, trying to work with David Beckham. But actually, once you got him on his own, well, actually, he was never on his own. There was always some PR person with a BlackBerry typing away next to us. But once you got him chatting about his clear passion for football and making it in football, and everyone I've spoken to since who played with David Beckham talks of this incredible work rate, and it really came across speaking to him about it. So it was a fascinating, enjoyable, sometimes infuriating project, that one.
No, it sounds fascinating. Thanks for sharing your memories of that. If people wanted to get a hold of that book, as I'm sure there'll be sort of renewed interest, what's that book called and is it still available?
Well, that's a good question. It was called Making It Real, HarperCollins, Making It Real by David Beckham. I think they changed the name of they put in a reprint, and I think it was called something else, which is awful. I don't remember. That's what us ghostwriters do. We move on. But I think, I don't know, I'd be interested to see if it's still on Amazon or any other sort of bookseller. I'd like to, if any of your listeners find it, let me know.
No, we will do. That should be an interesting follow-up in itself. I want to ask you, you have some fantastic quotes from footballers and journalists alike on the cover of your latest book. How hard is it to gain respect as a writer in these kind of environments? And what would you say was your breakthrough?
Well, having got my chance at 442 magazine, where I went as an intern, actually, they do month-long... 442 used to do month-long internships, work experience, basically, where you do the menial stuff, cut out cuttings from the day's papers, make the tea, often be told to go and get bacon sandwiches for everyone, which was fine. I'd come into it a little bit older, so I was sort of, I think I was about the same age as the editor, but, you know, you swallow your pride and you do it. And actually, 6 months later, I was still there because I just thought, no one's asked me to leave, so I'll just hang about. So that got me in, and it was a Haymarket Publishing, so they were doing other football magazines too, and I sort of got to know people there very well, and I slowly became a freelancer without really thinking about it. So the more and more interviews I was getting, I had contacts in the game because of my dad, which helped with journalists, and I got more and more sort of players and managers and coaches to sort of know me. But I guess my big break was that Gordon Strachan book in terms of publishing. Gordon liked it, which helped. I became quite pally with Gordon. I did a column for him for a while on 442. So that all sort of snowballed. And then, as I say, the Strachan book was nominated for Best New Writer in a British Sports Book Award. So that was good recognition. And I guess you just end up knowing, in terms of the quotes on my book, a lot of the people that have quoted helped me with the book. So you've already got that connection with them. I'd interviewed them all. I think they kind of sensed that I half knew what I was talking about. So, you know, and you have relationship with people. You kind of know who to cold call and say, look, you couldn't just do me a favor and put this, give me a quote for the blurb, as we call it. And you call in some favors, I guess. I say call in some favors. I bet some of them could call me for favors, but I doubt any of them need me to.
The Premier League is one of the most glamorous products because it's become an entertainment product in recent years. It's a global business, whatever way we look at it. I just wondered, given your extensive knowledge of football at the highest level, what's your view on the Premier League's response to the global pandemic initially? Because it felt to me, from reading a lot of sports columnists, that there were quite a few missteps at the beginning. I just wondered how you felt they'd responded and actually, did they learn a lot of lessons from this experience?
I don't know if I fully agree that there was missteps. I mean, thinking back, we were all in just such, I mean, a year ago this week, we were all in such a flux, weren't we? We didn't know what was happening or what was coming. Football closed down quite quickly. I think football should have closed quicker. The Champions League, UEFA probably had a bit to answer for there. I think the game that stands out is the Liverpool versus Atletico Madrid game at Anfield that, you know, Spain was on lockdown, yet, and this I think goes beyond football, I think it's more the politics of it, that the authorities allowed 4,000 Madrid fans who weren't allowed out in their own city to come to Liverpool. The data showed that there was a big spike in Liverpool due to that. In terms of the Premier League as an organisation, I think I'd have to read up more about it, but my memory serves, did what they had to do, and it shut. Players weren't given any special treatment. There was, you know, social media, football club social media was full of videos of players training from home on Zoom all together. Even, you know, then we're talking the elite clubs. Everything was shut down. And then once they started the project, you know, they took their time. You know, there were lots of people, let's not forget, calling for this, the whole season to be null and void. I think of Karen Brady at West Ham, who, using her column in the Sun newspaper, wrote a scathing piece about how football didn't matter given the deaths, and let's stop it. Now, the agendas on show there are quite frightening, because West Ham were in the relegation zone at the time. Now they're up near the Champions League places, and people were dying over Christmas. She was conspicuously silent on the matter. So I think the Premier League didn't listen to outside voices. I think they kept their noses clean and waited. And whilst we can criticise the Premier League juggernaut, I don't see what else they could have done, really. I mean, you might remind me, Sam, what people felt were the missteps.
Well, I'm just thinking of clubs that were perceived to be taking advantage of the furlough scheme. I mean, that would be one example. I think a lot of clubs that were initially criticised for such things ended up doing a lot of great work in their local communities, supporting the NHS and donating funds. And obviously, footballers themselves got together. I think the captains of the Premier League got together to do a lot of very worthwhile work. My own reflection on it, as somebody sort of interested in the game, is that there was good and bad. I think there was probably, on balance, there was probably more good than bad, but I think the initial reaction heated up the press columns.
Absolutely, absolutely. The furlough thing did leave a nasty taste, didn't it? Again, people weren't really, this was all so new, wasn't it? Furloughs and all the talk around them was just something new within the game. What I think it did do was shine a light on some preconceptions of football and those who play it. I think the easy route, and the route taken by cabinet ministers, let's not forget the health minister Matt Hancock, went for football, probably thinking it was an easy target. The zeitgeist is, oh, footballers don't care, they're paid too much, when it really backfired on him, because footballers, from working with them, do far more good than bad. Yeah, there's lots of young men earning far too much money we don't contemplate as the general public, but these are the vast majority of them give back and do loads of stuff that isn't, and they don't want publicity for it. Now, let's take Matt Hancock's statement about footballers not caring, and Jordan Henderson, as you say, led the club captain's push to give to the NHS and didn't want that. I know Jordan's agent quite well, and he didn't want publicity for that. He wanted it to be a private, quiet thing, but I think it was quite right that it did come out that he and then later Marcus Rashford, of course, sent the government's words packing in a way, because they've, if anything, footballers has come out of this with its reputation enhanced, while the government probably hasn't.
Really interesting to hear your views on that, Leo. You know, as somebody that knows a lot of people away from the public side, the public perception and the image that footballers have. I just wondered, you mentioned Marcus Rashford there, and he's been very vocal on a whole range of subjects. I mean, in terms of the Black Lives Matter sort of initiative in football, I mean, what's your view on that? Do you think that's been effective? There seems to be a lot of debate now about whether it should carry on. And again, I think that's, ironically, I think it's been politicised. I don't see it as a political initiative at all, although some people clearly do. But do you think it's an effective thing? Do you think things like that are taken notice of? I mean, given as well the continued abuse of black players on social media as well.
I think it's multifaceted and tricky for a lot of people to talk about. The fact that what you say, it's been debated. Now, that's a good thing. That has to be the start, doesn't it? Debated in a way. Now, I think over the summer with the George Floyd killing, it did have a good place in the game. I think it sort of, as I say, got the agenda being talked about. But we have to listen to those people that are most affected by this. So whilst the gesture has shone a light on it, I listen to people like Les Ferdinand at QPR, the director of football at QPR, who is very vocal on this. And actually, whilst telling his players they could do what they want, he said as a club they didn't support it. He was sick of gestures. I think that's the problem we have with this at the moment. It's always gestures. It's kick it out, wear a T-shirt twice a season, have a day. You know, the Premier League says it's a day of, it's similar to Black History Month, where, yes, it does feel like a gesture sometimes. And what they need is actions. They need people involved in the hierarchy of the game who have experience of this, who don't want just a talking shop. So I think whilst the Black Lives Matter and taking the knee has generated a conversation, it now has to just be the start of something. And if it finished next week, I think that would be okay. But as long as there's then actions behind it, I think the taking the knee has started something, but let's not let it be the thing football does, because more and more black footballers are certainly saying they're not going to do it. Wilfred Zaha at Crystal Palace has given his very articulate reasons why he will stop now. And as they say, as the players affected are still getting abused, why take a knee? You know, let it play out, but let there be actions now, because this just has to be the start. And you know, football has a role to play in getting rid of this in society. It can't just be held up as the thing to get rid of it. It has to play a role.
No, absolutely. I couldn't agree more with you. I must ask you, we talked about the pandemic and its impact on football and how football has carried on. I think it's probably fair to say that you have a fondness for Liverpool FC. I hope I'm not I hope I've not got that wrong. I'm just picking that up from the books that you've published in the past. If any club feels the benefit of having fans in, it's certainly Liverpool are one of the clubs that are able to generate incredible atmospheres. You mentioned Crystal Palace there as well, of course. What changes do you think fans will be subject to in the future? Are you getting any sense of what life will be like for a football fan in the future? I mean, clearly, football has missed fans. It's not been the same game. The atmosphere has been different. But what are you hearing, either from authorities in the game or players, about what the experience will be like if we ever actually do get supporters back into stadiums?
Well, I'm hearing more from match-going supporters, really, and fan groups. And it's quite a pessimistic hypothesis, really, that things will not be normal for quite a long time. Now, like everything, I think the authorities want to spin it, put a good glow on it, that this June date and the Euros this summer and we'll get fans in. But, you know, a lot of fans I speak to, and I go a lot myself, you know, a half-empty ground is only just as good as an empty one. And without that full contact, how do we move forward? You know, it's not going to be the same for a little while. And it makes one sad, doesn't it, to think that football stadiums are going to be this sort of a full football stadium, and that moment you score a goal and, you know, finding yourself in an embrace with a stranger could be a thing of the past. Because where do we go from there? It takes away the sheer... I mean, VAR is doing its best to take away that spontaneous pleasure anyway. But what with COVID on top, and the idea that maybe people would sit apart and it would be, you know, a third full, then a, you know, a quarter full or a half full, still feels really sad. So I don't know if we're looking at two or three years of this. Who knows? That's for others to say. But what I'm hearing aren't very optimistic noises.
Really interesting to hear that note of realism in your answer. Very considered sort of response. So thank you for that. I wanted to move on to a slightly more positive and upbeat note, which is I wondered if you, Leo, had a favourite column or an article that you'd written. One, because you felt it was a good piece of writing on football or sport, but also because of the reaction you got to it. Do you have any sort of pieces from your career that you're particularly fond of on that basis?
You know what, as you're asking that, one that sprang into my mind, and I might change my mind later, but one that sprang into my mind was a piece I did for 442 magazine about nearly 10 years ago. I can tell you when it was, because it was to mark an anniversary. It was 2012. And it was to mark the anniversary of very famous giant killing. Hereford United beat Newcastle United in the FA Cup. Now, Hereford were a Southern League team, non-league. Newcastle were mighty Newcastle, with the likes of Malcolm Super Mac McDonald up front of his big sideburns. We're a big First Division club. You know, they'd reached the cup final 2 years later, but they went to Hereford. Actually, Hereford went to Newcastle and got a very credible draw and took them back to Hereford and beat them 2-1. And there's the famous goal by Ronnie Radford that's sort of a 40-yard screamer into the top corner. And the pitch invasion that followed is like a 1970s fashion statement, because everyone's got those Parker jackets with the furry hoods. All these kids with long hair and flared jeans running on. And I got to go and I went up to Hereford and actually became... got very close to a lot of the players and the manager then and the board. I even met, there was a guy on the Hereford board who was actually a bobby on the beat, a policeman that day. And his job was to try and stop the pitch invasion. But being a huge Hereford fan, he just thought, sod it, if you can't beat them, join them, and came running on himself. So it was a sort of oral history of that occasion. I spoke to Malcolm McDonald, who gave me the Newcastle point of view. And it was such an emotive and evocative time and match, and iconic. Whenever the FA Cup starts, you'll see clips from that goal on Football Focus and Match of the Day. It was actually the game that John Motson got his big break. He was just a young commentator coming out of radio onto TV, and they gave him this game that they presume would be, you know, not really shown, but because of the magnitude of the result, he got the main game on Match of the Day. I think it was probably only one game on Match of the Day anyway, but it was his game. And from there, his career, he calls it the day he got his break, you know, and I spoke to John about it. And I just remember loving how innocent and real it was. And I'm not one to say modern football is this awful thing, because we all still love it, and I certainly love it. And of course, there's far too much money in it, but that's the way people want to do it. They want to watch it on TV, so that brings money. But going back to your question, it's, yeah, that piece and that, and the people I met, and just how friendly. I mean, they ended up inviting me to the anniversary banquet at Hereford, which was wonderful. I went with John Motson. And that really brings back great memories. My father had just died as well, actually, not long before I went there and wrote it. And a lot of the guys remembered my dad. So I think that kind of was quite moving on a personal note to me, and I just remember really enjoying doing it, and the response in the magazine loved it, and hopefully some of the readers did too.
It's very heartening to hear that even you grisly, cynical old journalists who've been writing about this game for years still feel you still have that memory of the innocence and the romance of football when you first came into contact with it. I mean, I certainly am a bit of a football romantic myself. My earliest memories of football are probably, as a seven-year-old, probably showing my age here, the 1982 World Cup, the Zico, Socrates, Oscar, Edea vintage of Brazil, playing just fantastic football and actually being knocked out by the Italian system of Zoff and Paolo Rossi. And it's also, I also have quite funny memories of football. You mentioned John Motson there. And I think he really used to come out with some absolute gems. And I know, obviously, we talked about Liverpool there, but his soundbite of the crazy gang of beating the Culture Club on the full-time whistle of an FA Cup final was a sort of particular moment of genius. I suppose the other thing that sticks in my mind in terms of these kind of headlines around football or hooks, I remember there was a year, I think this is going back about 20 years ago, but Inverness Caledonian Thistle once created a shock in the Scottish Cup by knocking Celtic out. And I think the headline in The Sun was, "Super Cali go ballistic, Celtic are atrocious." I imagine just the hilarity in the newsroom at the time when somebody came up with that, because it ended up taking up most of the back page of The Sun at some point. Do you have a favourite kind of moment in football? I mean, I've just shared a very sort of random hodgepodge of boyhood memories and things that have amused me. Is there anything that sort of stands in your memory as one of the greatest ever moments in football?
Well, I don't want to repeat and bore your listeners, but I think that game you mentioned, the Brazil v Italy game, was such... I mean, if someone wasn't into football, a youngster wasn't into football, and watched that game on that spring day in 1982 and with the crackly commentary coming from Spain, not even that far away, but John Motson's crackly commentary. It was like a net being thrown over a kid, wasn't it, that game? Because if you weren't into football, how could you not be after that? And I obviously was already into football, and I knew that my dad was there. He'd rung me from the press box before the game to tell me that it was so hot that day in Seville, I think that. Was it? No, the game was in Barcelona, actually, wasn't it? It was so hot that his trainers had melted to the pavement, which totally threw me and blew my mind. And then he said, "Watch this game, because he told me it would be a real clash of two styles," which he was very right. So sort of knowing my dad was there and then watching this Even the colour looked different that day. The sort of the yellow and blue contrast, and in this beautiful blue sky and this packed ground, and all you could hear were these drums from the Brazilian fans, which of course we didn't hear any. You know, it was so new. And if I wasn't already very much into the game, I remember thinking, one, why are this brilliant team lost? How is that possible? Why is that allowed? Not knowing the sort of ins and outs and how well Italy played that day, even if they were slightly cynical at times, but you had to do what you had to do against Socrates, Zico and the rest. So that was a real moment for me. And, you know, then when you're that young, the fact your dad's writing about the game, I remember going into school saying, my dad was there, and getting quite a lot of kudos at primary school for that. So that would be very much a big moment. In terms of my Liverpool supporting career, I remember winning the double in 86, and Liverpool hadn't really won the FA Cup in my time. In 74, I was one, so obviously I didn't get a ticket. But in 86, to win the FA Cup was such a big thing. I was used to Liverpool winning leagues and European Cups, so I was very spoiled, obviously. But lifting the FA Cup and winning the double just seemed like such a, you know, you heard about doubles from Arsenal and Tottenham in black and white, and it was sort of this iconic thing. And then for my team to do it against Everton, I remember leaving that game and thinking, this is the pinnacle. Ian Rush, two goals. We were 1-0 down at half time. It was looking very bad. And then they took over, and Rush was a big hero of mine, and it just seemed perfect.
I too was gutted that day when Brazil were knocked out of the World Cup. I felt very crestfallen as a boy who loved football. And I don't think I ever felt the same excitement or rush watching a Brazil team again. Obviously, there were great moments in the following years. I wanted to ask you, Leo, do you have a favourite interview, either for the book you've just written or a favourite football interview just generally in your career?
Oh, golly. You know, I won't speak for all writers, but I'm sure some of them would agree that whilst we're all grown men with children of our own, football can make you feel like a kid again. We've alluded to it in this chat. And I guess when I've sat down with, say, Ian Rush, which I've done a few times, I often think, what am I doing here? Sitting, chatting about and just bringing up memories and getting a first-hand account of things that made me so happy as a boy. That remains special. It doesn't have to just be Liverpool players. You know, you feel very privileged to sit and ask questions of the older players. Lovely interview with Ian St. John, who recently died, who gave me his memories of a particular match for Liverpool in the 60s. And to watch someone who was there and who helped create the modern team that I support was very special. In terms of my new book, there's two that stand out. In the early days of the book, when I was actually just pitching it to the publisher, they wanted a chapter. So I got hold of Terry Butcher, who was so generous with his time. And I told him what I wanted to do. And I wanted to give centre-backs a sort of platform and to shine a light on the position. And he was audibly impressed. And I think I actually made him quite emotional. I took him back to a fictitious game and said, what was it like if your team was 1-0 up at somewhere like Old Trafford and it was backs against the wall and 60,000 people screaming for you to fail? And I'm not going to say I made Terry Butcher cry, because I don't think anyone can say that, but there was definitely emotion in his voice as he just said how much he loved those moments. And he said he used to shout to his teammates, "Thou shall not pass." So that's when I thought, right, there's my title sorted out. And I then, as I say, got to interview Virgil van Dijk for the book, which really I really wanted to get that interview because it brought it. I interviewed a lot of players, current and former players, but to get the name that sort of people think about today and to get his take on the tactics of the position, how it's played in Holland, what the Premier League's like, obviously, and what is expected of the modern centre-half, really brought it together. And that was one of the Zoom ones. So I clicked on and there was this colossal man cooking pasta in his very nice kitchen. And we did the interview from there. So that will probably stay with me, that one. But I mean, so many great, very privileged to have talked to people within the game. Bobby Robson was a wonderful interview. Really, what a generous, kind, knowledgeable, insightful football man. He will be one that stands out for me too. I could probably sit and something will pop in my head and I'd say that, but it's been a lot. But yeah, they're the ones that kind of come to mind now.
I was tickled by your mention of the start of our interview of the vegan dinners of choice of Premier League footballers. What can you give us a sample? What a couple of the vegan dinners of choice might be on the Premier League dinner table of an evening?
More and more of them are turning to veganism, aren't they? I don't really know the subject well enough myself. I tell you what I do hear they've eaten is, if you want a pudding, a chocolate mousse, which is made of avocados. There you go. That's a vegan staple, apparently. But I'll probably just stick with the chocolate mousse. I've got nothing to lose anymore.
Well, that's the kind of insight I think we can only get on the Comms from the Shed podcast, frankly, Leo. So thank you very much for that nugget. I'm just going to finish up with a couple of quick questions. Thank you for being so generous with your time. Are there writers that you really respect? I mean, who do you like following and what writers do you enjoy reading? Whose work do you tend to follow yourself?
Sam Pilger is an excellent writer and I adore everything he puts down on paper. He might be listening. So Sam, definitely Sam Pilger. You know, you can't help but read. I often go back to I've got a book, Hugh McIlvany on football. Again, a fellow countryman of yours, Sam, who just does paint incredible pictures. And if you just delve into that book and different chapters on football and other sports, actually his work on boxing is just goes beyond sports writing. I think it's sort of writing that transcends the genre. Patrick Barkley's another one, another Scotsman, actually. It's quite interesting to have a chat solely on that. Football, Scotland's contribution to football isn't just how skillful they made the game, nor for the border, but how people who observe the game, how skillfully they do it too. And Patrick Barkley would be right up there as well. I love reading Paddy's work. You know, the current crop, there's so many good ones. Henry Winter comes up and he's prolific and knows so much. And so he knows so much about the game. He's just so immersed in the game, which I really respect. So, yeah, you know, it's becoming more and more respected, isn't it? I think, you know, I mentioned Frank Keating earlier, Hugh McIlvany. I'm lucky enough to be able to delve into my dad's work, John Moynihan. And, you know, these are real giants of the game. I'm not sure how any of those old guys would have coped with, you know, the very quick turnaround, like deadline, match day, you need to have your piece done probably before the end of the game, just for the online content. And my father certainly would have struggled tweeting. I think that would have baffled him. He once asked me what an email was. So I think we're looking at these are people that would be in the bar as quick as they can after a game on a Saturday. So I envy them that. I must say, I envy that those smoke-filled room days, I guess, of maybe it was a bit more real. But there are many more writers now, and it's not to the game's detriment. There's so much great content out there. I mean, it's maybe too much of it, but you can get lost sometimes. But if you know where to look, there's still a lot of it. And the newspaper guys are fantastic.
This may have been just towards the end of the smoke-filled days, or maybe in that period between the old era of football and the more modern game. But you mentioned Gordon Strachan there. I heard a story once that Alex Ferguson followed Gordon Strachan home because he wanted to sort of check up on him, make sure that he wasn't going to bars or clubs, and he got an incredible fright when Ferguson sort of turned up in a bar, I think it was. Did he tell you any stories like that about Alex Ferguson? And what was the funniest story that Gordon told you about his footballing career? Because he is a proper character, obviously, for people that know about him.
Yeah. I mean, that was the reason I got the gig to write his story, because he'd become this sort of cult hero on Match of the Day. People would wait for his post-match interviews. You know, I think the famous one was, can we have a quick word, Gordon? And he said, velocity, and walked away. Very, very sharp-witted. I think his relationship with Fergie was always a tricky one, because most people cow down to Alex Ferguson, even in his early Aberdeen days. But Gordon was this very quick-witted, is this very quick-witted Edinburgh boy who won't suffer fools. I kind of was lucky enough to get my own Strachan put down, which I'll tell you. I finished writing about Gordon. As I say, it wasn't with Gordon, but I got his blessing and so cracked on and wrote this book about him. And I sent a copy to Gordon, having sort of got to know him a little bit. I gave it a month or two, and then we were talking about something else. I rang him up and I said, "Oh, by the way, Gordon, did you like my book?" And he sort of tentatively said, I won't do his accent actually, because you'll just laugh at me. But he said, "Yeah, no," but he was sort of not very forthcoming about it. And I said, "No, you can say if you didn't like it." He went, No. My wife Leslie really liked it." And I said, "Okay, that's good, but can I ask if you liked it?" And again, he was a bit hesitant. And I said, "Really, I can take criticism." He said, "Right, Leo, I'm going to come clean. I started reading it, but then I realized I know the ending," which sort of must be weird reading someone else's book about you when you know your own life. So that was my very own personal Gordon Strachanism, and God bless him for it.
Final question, Leo. Obviously, people can read your book now about centre-halves, and you've given us some great insight into that. So Thou Shall Not Pass is out on Bloomsbury now, as I mentioned at the top of the show. What projects do you have in the pipeline, or what are your hopes for the future? What more would you still like to do as a writer?
Wow, that's the million-dollar question, Sam. Gosh, that's an existential question that I'm not sure I can answer. I think I'm more and more... The world's changing very much for everyone. More and more I'm into publishing. I like the space it gives you. I like getting one's own ideas to publishers and trying to actually make a physical thing that goes on a bookshelf. I love the idea of writing books. I mean, I'm still ghosting. I've just done a book with Andy Cole, the Manchester United centre forward, that came out before Christmas, and that was a success. So I'm always trying to sort of daydream about my ideal ghosting project. Who knows what's around the corner? But with that, I've got, without going too into it, because it's not really off the path yet, I'm looking at maybe some kids' books with a football theme. So a bit of non-fiction. You know, we all think we've got a novel in us, but maybe some story for younger children, but using football as the hook. I've got a daughter who's 13 now, and she likes to read, but she's not a football fan. But I know lots of parents whose kids, it's hard to find something to read, but if you can get the thing they love within the book, i.e. football, then who knows? So, you know, that's something I'm working on. So watch this space. I'll let you all know.
That sounds great. And what are your predictions for all the big sort of trophies before the end of the year, both domestically and internationally? Who do you see winning the big prizes in the weeks and months ahead?
Well, it looks obvious that Liverpool are going to let Manchester City have the Premier League on loan for a year. So that's that done. I think the talk of the quadruple is an interesting one, because this team do look like a machine, don't they? But my prediction is that I think City will win a treble. I think they'll win everything. But you know what? I think for some reason Tottenham will beat them in the League Cup final. I've got this feeling that everyone's so going after Mourinho. He's going to come out with something, some sort of trick. They're going to defend very well that day at Wembley, whenever it is. You could tell me. I don't know when that game is, actually. And then that front three, or Bale and Kane, might just hit them, and that could be the one they lose. So there you go. You heard it here first, folks.
On that bombshell, as a famous comedic character once said. Leo, thanks very much. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. We ventured into areas I didn't think we would, but it was all the better for it. So thank you so much for your time. And please keep checking back on future episodes of Comes From The Shed. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening to the latest episode of Comes From The Shed. Hit subscribe if you want to know when new episodes are available, or check out our Instagram page for the latest updates.